So as we discussed in the sleep episodes, this is why it's important to, I usually say around 8 o'clock, start to turn lights down, start to dim your phone, have your phone switch over to a different light, not the blue light, but like the more yellowy light that can be on your electronic devices. But start to avoid light so that your body can start to produce melatonin, because melatonin is your body's way of preparing for sleep. You know, like we said, it's not a sleeping pill.
I'm Dr. Tina Kayser, and as Leah likes to say, I'm the sciencey one.
And I'm Dr. Leah Sherman, and I'm the cancer insider.
And we're two naturopathic doctors who practice integrative cancer care.
But we're not your doctors.
This is for education, entertainment, and informational purposes only.
Do not apply any of this information without first speaking to your doctor.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast by the hosts and their guests are solely their own.
Welcome to the Cancer Pod. Hello, Tina.
Hello, Leah.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, 2023.
Woo!
So this is one of those moments where I think back to when I was young, and I was born 1971, and it was inconceivable to think about where I might be in the year 2020, 2023 in this case. Inconceivable.
Did you ever watch that show, Space 1999?
Mm-mm.
So it was really cool. It was like with Martin Landau and Barbara Bain. And it was about like these people went and colonized the moon. And then something happened and the moon tore out of Earth's orbit and it's just pummeling through space. So it's like its own little like spaceship kind of, but it's the moon and people live on it. And that took place in 1999.
Really? Well, this is funny because all these futuristic movies back then would be like only 50 years later or 30 years
later. I know. Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, we're not living on the moon and the moon is still attached in our orbit.
Thankfully.
But yeah, there was something else that was like, was it Terminator or something where like somebody was born? There was some movie trivia thing where like a main character was born in like 2022, which is just crazy that like that seemed so far away. Yeah, 2023, far away, but it's like just in a few weeks. But yeah. I mean, we're releasing this in 2023, but we're recording it ahead of time because we're, you know, we're on it.
Yeah, because we're so diligent.
That's right. We're professional.
That's our New Year's resolution. That's my New Year's resolution.
I don't even know what to say.
True that. Okay.
True that. So, Tina, what are we talking about today?
We're going to talk about melatonin.
Which is awesome because we have had several requests to discuss melatonin, and in particular, its role in cancer care.
Oh, and you know what? You bringing in the moon into this conversation is actually appropriate because melatonin in diurnal rhythms or a 24-hour rhythm of our system, it's all linked. It's all connected.
That was not even intentional. That was just because of like, yeah, it's one of those random pieces of trivia that fills the voids of my brain.
Is any of it random, Leah? Really?
It really isn't, is it? All right. So what the heck is melatonin? We know it's like a pill that you can buy in the store and you take it to go to sleep. But what is melatonin, Tina?
Well, I'm not going to get into the chemistry. And I told you before we hit the record button that I'm going to try not to go too deep into the weeds on this.
You're trying not to nerd out.
I'm trying not to nerd out and use chemistry, but it is, as all molecules in the body are, it is a chemical compound that we produce. It's a hormone, essentially.
Which I think is big, mm-hmm. that it's a hormone.
Yes, it's an actual hormone that our body makes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just any molecule, it's a hormone. And a hormone, just for the record, a hormone is a molecule that signals organ systems on a cellular level, but it still is a signal bearer that is produced in one section of the body, travels to other sections of the body, and has a physiological effect. So a hormone, by definition, is influencing the behavior of cells and in influencing the behavior of organs ultimately. So I just want to put that out there because it's a powerful thing. When we say a hormone, you know, it's much more powerful than saying an amino acid or a protein or a sugar molecule. A hormone elicits an action within the cell. It actually forces an action within the cell. So I'm just saying that because it's very different than a vitamin.
Right. And I think that's a really important thing for people to know.
Mm-hmm. Because in the United States, we can buy melatonin over the counter. And in Canada as well, I believe. In certain parts of the world, it's not a nutritional supplement. It's not offered on the shelf.
Right.
Because they consider it something that people should not be taking. Ready for it? We say it all the time. Willy-nilly.
It's the first willy-nilly of the year. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think there are a lot of studies that have been coming out, like, should you be taking melatonin? And we'll talk about why people take it and all of that stuff. But where... You said it's made in one part of your body and it signals other organs and tissues. So where in your body is melatonin made?
It's most notoriously made in the pineal gland in our brain.
See, pineal, that's what I was waiting. I wanted you to say it because I didn't know if it was pineal or pineal. Is it like pecan or pecan?
Pecan. I think there could be an emphasis wherever you want to put it.
An emphasis. I like pineal because it makes it like pie.
It makes you sound like you're from the South.
Pineal. Okay. I just wanted to clear that up. Okay. So it's made in your brain, in the pineal gland.
And it is made in other parts of the body as well. So it does. This is it's most notoriously known for its role in our circadian rhythm. It's known as the master hormone behind our 24-hour rhythm of various hormones. So as humans, we have a diurnal rhythm, which means that we should be sleeping at night and awake in the daytime. And that's as opposed to nocturnal rythms, right, of cats or rodents. They're nocturnal. They have
hedgehogs.
The opposite rhythm.
Hedgehogs. I know people who've had pet hedgehogs and they are nocturnal.
Okay. I wasn't aware of that, but this is why we do the show, to learn really important factoids like that.
From each other. Yeah. I'm here to teach.
It is quickly released from the pineal gland in the dark. So I love the image of a ball rolling down a hill and you have something holding it back. And what's holding that ball back in this case is daylight. And as soon as the daylight goes away, that ball rolls down the hill. That's basically melatonin from serotonin. So serotonin is made in our brain all day long. The lights are keeping it from becoming melatonin. The lights that hit our eyes signal the pineal gland. When the lights go out, the serotonin that you normally make now becomes melatonin. And it's just daylight inhibits the enzyme. So when the daylight is gone, the darkness then allows the serotonin to become melatonin.
And I think that is one of the coolest things. And I told you before we started recording, I want to find this one image that shows the serotonin pathway, which is like how serotonin is made. And you see melatonin in there. And the image I'm thinking of in particular also shows like all of the nutrients that our body needs in order to produce those hormones.
Cool.
And I think it's also an important connection because serotonin is what we mostly think of when we think about mood and depression. And mm-hmm. So knowing the connection between melatonin and serotonin, I think is really important.
Yeah. So a serotonin low state is connected to depression, and serotonin and melatonin are made naturally in our bodies, ultimately from tryptophan. Tryptophan is a essential amino acid that gives rise to the serotonin. So we create the serotonin, but we need the building blocks to create serotonin and thus melatonin. The building block in this case is tryptophan, is the essential amino acid as part of that process. And there's some nutrients in here as well, like vitamin B6 that we have to have enough of to make this process go forward.
B12. So that makes me think, like, so if somebody is a vegetarian or especially a vegan, mm-hmm. and they're deficient in those nutrients that helped create serotonin and melatonin, I mean, it's important to make sure that they are getting some sort, I'm not saying to take a B12, but maybe just do some more nutritional yeast or, you know, find some other sources of those building blocks.
Yes, I will. I'm going to give a personal story. It's a rarity.
Wow.
That's how we're going to start the year. This is me. Gloves are off.
As I laugh, I'm like,
you're like, this is hysterical.
Oh, she's opening up. All right.
It's like a shooting star.
Tell us.
Okay. So I did labs on myself because I'm a naturopath and I hadn't done labs in many years. And so I was like, I'll just do a wellness panel. And long story short, my serum B12 was low. Now, I eat really well and I'm vegetarian but I do eat fish.
Well, right? we talked in a previous episode how you're like
I'm more pescatarian.
Ovo, pesco,
cheeso. I eat fish. I eat cheese.
Cheesotarian.
I think that's a lacto vegetarian.
Okay. I'm going with cheeso because you don't drink milk.
No, I don't. But that's because I don't like it. In any case, serum B12 is not easily low. In other words, it's not an easy vitamin that shows up in serum. So for it to show up low in my blood work means that it's probably been low, dipping down in low.
Right, because it's stored in your liver. Like when people take high amounts of B12, like it may get stored up in your liver.
I'm not one of those people who does high dose B12 or B vitamins or anything like that, but I take vitamins here and there now and again and, you know, make sure that I'm not deficient or I thought I was. But I eat really well, like 30 vegetables in a week, that goal, that was, I think I hit it in, you know, a few days, no problem, because I always eat a lot of vegetables. I eat grains, I eat roots, I eat berries, I eat fruit, I eat, you know. So I was a bit surprised. And I wondered if maybe I should be more of an omnivore given my heritage. So my heritage is Polish, Italian, and Irish, and all of those tend to be omnivore diets. So there's not a vegetarian ancestry that I can look back on, right? So anyways, with all of this in mind, I did it. I ate a homemade smash burger.
Wait, you ate beef?
I did it. I took the plunge.
And?
It's been 7 years plus. I didn't even like meat growing up.
I know. That's what you were saying before.
No, it's not something I would do for anything but health reasons. But what I did was I took a piece of bread, I put mayo on it, and then I put cheese on it, and I put all sorts of things to cover it up, basically. And it was a smash burger, so it was as thin and well done as it could be.
That was fine. Sounds horrible.
I know.
You lost me at mayo, but and then well done just sealed it. Like if you invite me over for a smash burger, I'm going to decline.
It's all about the toppings because I really didn't care about the meat, but I did do it in the name of
B12.
Respecting my heritage and knowing that my B12 was low, maybe because that's my, you know, I'm not eating a heritage diet when I eat pescatarian.
And for anyone who's curious and hasn't listened to prior episodes, the heritage diet, we will put a link to that Old Ways website if you're curious.
Yeah. They've done a good job of looking at various heritage diets mostly by continent, so that you can see the various pyramids, not just a Mediterranean diet, but what does it mean if you're from Asia or you're from Africa, et cetera.
Latin American countries. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're talking about food and melatonin and tryptophan, you know, these precursors are found in foods. So some of the foods that have the highest content would be like nuts and seeds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what's kind of cool is if you soak the nuts, like something like, you know, like almonds or whatever, and if you soak them, you sprout them, then that actually makes the melatonin more bioavailable. It increases I don't know if it makes it more bioavailable, but it like increases the content.
Interesting.
And then, because I looked it up, mustard seeds have like the highest amount. And I don't think one would really eat that many mustard seeds, but that's kind of a cool thing.
Has the highest amount of melatonin?
Melatonin. Yeah. I guess per, like if you look at the 100 grams or something, I need to recheck the chart, but I did write down mustard seeds because I thought that was a really interesting thing. It's used a lot obviously to make mustard, but I use it when I make khichdi. So it's used in Indian cooking and stuff.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's kind of a cool thing. So yeah, there's also an article that has a list of the melatonin content in different foods, but tart cherries are the other thing that people think about.
Yes.
And doing my research before falling down the rabbit hole, it's a particular type of tart cherry. It's just not any random tart cherry.
Did they tell us the type?
Yeah, but I can't, I don't know how to say it. Montmorency type. Yeah, it's in the article. But so different strains of like, you know, grapes or, you know, whatever the foods are that have melatonin contents, like the different, I guess, strains of food. Is that the word?
Different types of food?
Well, like you could, like if you have four different types of grapes.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Species.
Like, species. There you go. That's the word. Yeah. So mushrooms, tomatoes. Grains have melatonin. And what I also thought was very cool is the darker the rice, so like black and red rices have higher contents of melatonin. Mm-hmm. Wheat, barley, oats, coffee beans.
Whoop, whoop.
Has melatonin. And roasting it brings out makes a higher content. Not that I would recommend drinking coffee before bed, but...
How do I love thee? Let me count the ways.
You're just like, one more thing.
Let me put that on my list of things coffee does that benefit my health.
There you go. Look at you, got your coffee. And then in the animal kingdom, you've got like oily fish, eggs, and breast milk.
That's one of the ways the babies get their melatonin.
I guess so. Yeah. And of course, the list is much more comprehensive. I just kind of pointed out like the ones that I thought were particularly interesting.
Well, you know, I'm super duper competitive. Not. So I have a list of tryptophan foods.
Oh, awesome. Nice.
So those who just joined us, you'll know that Leia is diligent and does her homework. And I often just show up and start talking. And so for me to come up with a list... It was, you know, this is my new 2023 self showing already. All right. So number one on the list is milk. And so if you don't do milk and dairy, okay. Canned tuna was on the list. Turkey and chicken. Not surprising. These are high protein things. Like tryptophan is an amino acid. We don't need a lot of it. It's actually the lowest amount of required amino acid of all the essential amino acids. Anyways, turkey and chicken, I said. Oats, cheese, nuts and seeds. Chocolate, and some fruits have a little bit, but you know, fruit doesn't have much amino acid in general, so it's certainly not going to have as much tryptophan as high protein foods. But I want to mention one more thing. Since tryptophan is the essential amino acid that eventually can become serotonin and melatonin, tryptophan is also used to make a type of vitamin B3. So if the body is low in B3, there are priorities to every pathway in the body. It will prioritize the production of B3 over the production of serotonin. So if someone is low in B3, your body will probably not be low in B3 or niacin. It will probably sacrifice the production of serotonin in order to make enough B3 or niacin for your reactions in your body where that vitamin is needed. So it's an interesting thing because the body always has certain priorities to everything. And ultimately, survival is the top priority. So it will reshuffle its use of amino acids so that you can stay alive. It doesn't care about your mood at that point.
No, that's really cool. And speaking of B3, that kind of leads us into just a quick little brief review of why one would use a supplement instead of using food. Because we are always food first. Because food is so much more complex than an isolated nutrient in a supplement. Go back to episode number 20 and listen to Supplements 101, The Basics. We'll put a link in the show notes. And okay, so why do we use supplements? Just brief overview. To prevent or treat an acute nutrient deficiency. So like you were saying, like vitamin B3, that would be preventing pellagra. Vitamin C prevents scurvy, B1 beriberi, and to prevent rickets, you take vitamin D. And these are very low amounts. These are not high amounts. These are just low amounts that typically you can get from food.
Or the sunshine, vitamin D.
Or the sun, right. The second reason we would use a supplement is to prevent, delay, or to treat a chronic nutrient deficiency.
So fish oil might be a classic example of that.
Right. Yes. Taking fish oil. And then the third reason, and we kind of differ on our views of what green pharmacy is, but it's basically using it in place of or alongside conventional medicine, a prescription, in order to address a specific issue. So for melatonin, we most likely think of it for sleep.
Right. Because people are unlikely to have a deficiency per se of melatonin.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that taking a little extra for sleep isn't appropriate.
Right. So let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and we will talk about the use of melatonin for sleep. And after that, we're going to talk about the use of melatonin for cancer.
All right. See you on the other side.
All right, we're back. I'm kind of getting sleepy.
Just talking about it.
Now, yeah, you know, and I had a little bit of chicken with my lunch, so it's all that tryptophan is converting fast. And I had chocolate.
Oh, see?
Yeah.
Well, you need some more bright lights.
I know. The sun is shining, but I'm in my closet. Okay, so...
The sun's not shining in your closet.
It's not. It's my recording closet, my recording booth. Okay, we are back, and we are talking about melatonin for sleep.
So, yeah. So I think we can all agree. Let's start with common ground. There's decent evidence on the use of melatonin for sleep at doses that are somewhere very low dose all the way up to, I think the highest dose I've seen for sleep was 6 milligrams, but that's pretty unusual. It's usually 1 to 3 milligrams.
And there's a lot of controversy because people are able to buy up to 10 milligrams in the store. And I think because of the way that we think, where if a little is good enough, then more is better, that doesn't really necessarily apply with melatonin. Because it's not like melatonin is a sleeping pill. And it's not for everybody who has a sleep disturbance. As we discussed in our sleep disturbances episode.
Right.
I don't remember which ones those were. There were 2 episodes, 9 and 10, I think. So links below in our show notes. Links below. Like I'm on like YouTube.
You even pointed.
I did point. I'm like ready for YouTube. But okay. So
on that, what we talked about and we need to mention for sleep is first and foremost, optimize your own production.
Yes.
Darkness. Every little light counts in your room.
Mm-hmm.
So the easiest thing to do, you can go out and buy a nice mask. The Bucky mask is my favorite brand, but there's a bunch of them out there that keep the mask off of your eyelashes so you don't feel like your eyes are being pressed on. But really, just reach in your drawer, find a soft t-shirt, and put it over your eyes and see if you're waking up a lot, see if that helps. Because you might roll over and finally the t-shirt's on one side of the pillow, you're on the other, and you wake up. And you can kind of surmise that every time you're waking, that there's some light coming through. Because it goes right through your eyelid even, if there's a little ambient light.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. What I have done, if I wash my eye mask and it's air drying, is sometimes I'll just use like a knit cap, mm-hmm. like just, you know, a fleece.
You mean you put it on your head and then just cover your eyes?
Yeah. It works best in the winter when it's a little chilly. I try to keep my sleeping area, you know, cold. But yeah, there are other things that you can try. But I just ordered a sleep eye mask. I tried a different kind. It's got the little cups for your eyes, but it doesn't have clips on the side because I'm a side sleeper.
Mm.
And that makes a big difference because I would wake up because those clips were digging in my scalp.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I like this one. But we could put links somewhere of our favorite eye masks that we like.
That's a good idea.
But yeah, so patients will say, yeah, my room is really dark. And sometimes it is. And sometimes there is that ambient light. Like if you have to like fumble your way to get to the bathroom in the middle of the night because there's no light, it makes a big difference.
Yes, that's dark enough, you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes you can't control the light coming in, or you're sleeping with someone else in the room who really doesn't want it to be pitch dark because they want to fumble through the night and find the bathroom. So the masks are some way of, you know, making it dark while you're actually trying to sleep is ideal.
Right.
And I think there's another thing we have to mention about melatonin, whether you're making it yourself or you're taking it as a supplement, the half-life is pretty short. In other words, the time it takes for you to metabolize melatonin is only 30 to 60 minutes. So as your body is making it, it needs to continue making it through the night for you to have a sustained amount of melatonin that keeps you asleep into a deep restorative sleep. This is true when you take it as a supplement too. I should also say when you take it as a supplement, the most I've ever seen in its absorption rate was about a third of it being absorbed. So if you take a 3 milligram capsule orally, 1 milligram will make it into your bloodstream. Now that's still a pretty good dose compared to what your body is making.
Right, because your body makes it in picograms? I want to say like Pikachus, in picograms. So picograms, which I was like, how small is a picogram? I looked it up and it is 1 trillionth of a gram. And during the daytime, your body produces between 0 to 20 picograms per milliliter. And at night, it's 40 to 200 picograms per milliliter. So that is like the teeniest of tiniest of like infinitesimal, like
yes,
small amounts.
1 trillionth. Can I just, I want to say 1 trillionth. That's 9 zeros. No, 12 zeros. So that means if 1.0 is one, it's 0.00000000001.
So taking 1 milligram should suffice.
Yes.
Sometimes you can find a 0.5 milligram.
Yes.
But they're harder to find. It's hard to find low doses these days because everybody wants to take a 5 or a 10. And you don't need it for sleep.
I let people figure out their dose by starting with 0.5 milligram for sleep and then working their way up to 5 milligrams. Some of it's going to depend on their absorption rate and such.
Sure, sure.
And if it doesn't work at 5 and 6 milligrams for sleep, it's probably not going to work.
Right. It's probably not what they need for their sleep.
It's probably not the issue. Yes.
Yeah.
It does cross the blood-brain barrier very easily. It's considered lipophilic, you know, can pass through fat membranes very easily. So you should, once it reaches the bloodstream, or let's just say you have great absorption and you do absorb 1/3 of that 1 milligram. So now you've got 0.33 milligram that goes into your bloodstream. It should, at that point, cross into the blood-brain barrier without a problem. And that's still, you know, 1 trillion times more than your brain would be making.
So as we discussed in the sleep episodes, this is why it's important to, I usually say around 8 o'clock, start to turn lights down. Mm-hmm. You start to turn down, at least, you know, dim your phone, have your phone switch over to a different light, not the blue light, but like the more yellowy light that can be on your electronic devices, your Kindle, whatever, preferably reading a book, not a Kindle. But start to avoid light so that your body can start to produce melatonin, because melatonin is your body's way of preparing for sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, like we said, it's not a sleeping pill.
Right, right. So yes, this is why melatonin is considered the master hormone of our rhythm, of our night and day rhythm. It's a lot like the ocean. So going back to this whole moon circling the earth, we know the tides are governed by the moon and the magnetism between the moon and the earth, and the tides come in and the tides go out. Well, your hormonal cycles are a lot like that on a 24-hour, roughly 24-hour cycle, where you should be having these ups and downs of certain different hormones throughout the day. We're talking about cortisol being higher in the morning when you want to be awake. Cortisol should be very low when you go to sleep at night. Melatonin should be very low during the day. It should peak during the night. So we have all of these rhythms of various hormones in our body. And this includes these steroidal hormones as well, the estrogens and testosterone and such. So there's this idea that the clock itself and our clock genes, now we have these clock-controlled genes in all of our cells. Genes literally turn on and off in our cells. They're keeping track of time. So there's this whole set of genes called clock genes that do go awry in a lot of cancers. And so they're looking at clock genes in cancer. And they're different. The clock genes that are expressed in a tumor are different than those in the normal tissue nearby. So clock genes are thought to be one of the many ways in which cancer cells are different than normal cells. The clock genes will start behaving differently. So instead of being quiet at night, they might not be quiet. They might be causing the cells to proliferate in the middle of the night, that kind of thing. So clock genes are a whole topic that I would love to dedicate a whole episode to, because it's the most fascinating thing that the body keeps track of time. Melatonin is one master hormone in the whole story, but it's a much more intricate story with a lot of other players in it. See, this is me not geeking out. I did pretty good.
You did pretty good. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, like, this would be something, if we get our Patreon set up, that would be a really nice, you know, bonusy thing for a Patreon site. If we continue with this motivated attitude that we have right now.
Yes. If we continue this momentum. Yes.
Yeah. So as we kind of mentioned before the break, having those precursors to produce melatonin and, you know, serotonin is important. So making sure you are eating a well-rounded diet with some of the foods that we recommended. Practicing good sleep hygiene is important. And I just saw an article, which I saved on my phone. I didn't read it yet, but it talked about how weighted blankets may actually work by helping your body to produce melatonin.
Oh, yeah. So weighted blankets have been used to reduce anxiety in general. There was even a small pilot study using weighted blankets in the chemo room and showing that it calmed people down and was useful to reduce anxiety. So I didn't know it was actually calming in that sense too.
Yeah. Like I said, it was something that popped up in my news feed. And so I saved it to read later, but I will read it and then we'll put a link as well.
Great.
That would be fantastic in infusion rooms, because I know I do have a weighted blanket and I can't sleep with it because halfway through the night I have to turn over and it's too heavy for me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm like working out in the middle of the night to lift it, to roll underneath it. But in the infusion room, it's cold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you do have to get up and go to the bathroom, you know, sometimes several times. But yeah, I guess it would just be hard to keep them clean.
Yeah, there was a brand that was made by a nurse somewhere. I want to say she was in Ohio and they did a small clinical trial. I'll look it up because I had a link to that, and we can put that link in the show notes as well. But it was specifically made for the chemo room because she was an oncology nurse and she wanted to know if this might help because it was so simple.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I guess someone could bring their own weighted blanket. But yeah, I'm just thinking like if infusion rooms had them, they always have those white, super, super linty blankets that they'll just have in the warmer and you pull it out and then it's warm and then it's not. And then if you're wearing black, you get like lint all over you. But a weighted blanket would be nice because it's warm and it's anti-anxiety and it's just soothing and all of that. So what else would we think about melatonin?
Is that your doorbell?
Oh, yeah. Hold on. So is there anything else that we can add in terms of melatonin for sleep? You know, like making sure that there's not light disrupting it. And conversely, if you do wake up really groggy, whether or not you take melatonin, you wake up groggy, turn on light.
Mm-hmm.
Open windows if it is the time of year when there's light outside when you wake up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that whole, like, you know who can sleep right through all of that, of course, is teenagers, but they have much higher levels of melatonin. So young people and through their teenage years, and even in their early 20s, they have much higher levels of melatonin in their body, and they're not as sensitive to the light. Their enzymes are just more hardy to that light, so they can just sleep right through it. It's kind of a fascinating reason that everyone knows who has teenagers. They generally need more sleep.
Well, and I mean, we were all teenagers, and yeah.
I don't recollect what I did then, though.
I remember being able to sleep, you know. I do want to say that I do kind of encourage lower doses. I know that, you know, like you go up to 6 milligrams, but for people who think that the lower doses kind of help, there are extended release ones as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like some of those extended release ones because the half-life is so short.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then if it depends when, do you have trouble falling asleep in the first place, like, you know, at 10 or 11 at night, or do you have trouble because you wake up at 3? Or that those are two different issues, right? And so you want to time the melatonin to be peaking when you have your issues. And so you might take it just before bed for an instant release. Or if you're just someone who, I fall asleep fine, but I wake up at 2 or 3 every night, you might want to do the extended release.
So do you recommend people take it? I think we talked about this in the sleep issue. In sleep issue? Sleep episode. Timing when you take the melatonin. Because if you look at the packaging, it'll say take it 30 minutes before you go to bed. And so I will have patients, if they have a hard time falling asleep, take it 30 minutes before bedtime. But when you brush your teeth, make sure your lights are low. Like, keep those lights low. Like, just put on a nightlight in the bathroom to brush your teeth and to get ready for bed. So as opposed to like taking it once you're in bed.
Right, right. I find most people, well, this is not true of everyone, but it seems to me the majority of people have trouble when they wake up in the night and getting back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other option that you could try, it's all trial and error. Because melatonin is fairly inexpensive, I just have people try different ways of doing this. But there is melatonin in sprays and there's melatonin in drops as well. And so you could, instead of doing an extended release, roll over, especially if you can afford a couple more hours at least, and put it under your tongue and just see if you get an immediate release. Because again, it's 30 minutes to an hour, so you should burn through that in, 2 to 4 hours easily. When we say a half-life, just so we're clear, a half-life is a literal term that means in that time, let's just say it's 30 minutes for melatonin. In 30 minutes, if whatever dose you have at time point zero, in 30 minutes, you'll have half that dose.
So if you take 1 milligram in 30 minutes, you have 0.5 milligram in your body.
Yes. If you absorbed 1 milligram for whatever you're taking.
Right.
And that's what it's in your bloodstream. About 30 minutes later, you should have half of whatever was circulating 30 minutes ago. And that happens every 30 minutes, right? So essentially in, 5 half-lives or 7 half-lives, it's completely gone. So that's why you have to continue the production through the night to have enough to get you through the night. You have to keep producing the melatonin. And so, yes, if you're doing a supplement, you might keep that in mind.
And again, I mean, melatonin isn't always our go-to when somebody has sleep issues. So it's not like we're saying, oh, go out there and take melatonin for sleep, because that might not be what's going on with you.
Right.
Yeah. So, and we do cover that in our side of sleep disturbance episodes.
Yes.
Episodes. It was a two-parter because...
It was a two-parter because we got down. We got down with some details.
That's right. We nerded out. All right. So we're good with sleep?
Yes. I think we can all agree that melatonin is well proven in human clinical trials for sleep at a given dose. We'll talk about cancer and even side effects that can happen after the break.
Perfect. And we are back. We are talking about melatonin and melatonin for cancer in particular.
Yeah. So we have to give our hats off to a listener whose name is Tim.
Oh, Tim. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were several people who wanted us to talk about melatonin, like since we first put out our podcast, but we have been having a behind the scenes conversation with this one listener, Tim, and Tina.
It's okay. Everything we do is we. It's fine.
I know. It's, that's how it is. But yeah, and I've been having fun reading the emails between the two of you. And yeah, he sent us some articles, which I couldn't see most of them because they were abstracts and I don't have access. Like, I think you have a little more access than I do to certain articles. But yeah, we just want to thank you, Tim, for engaging us in conversation. And this is what we love about doing the podcast.
Yes. Yeah. And we were talking about this off camera, off mic, about how whether it's patients or listeners, pushing the envelope of knowledge, of our knowledge, is really a good thing. I mean, that's part of the fun, is saying, okay, let's revisit this topic because I already have an opinion. Tim sent us a bunch of papers. I delved into those and kind of just revisiting things because things change, evidence changes. And in this scenario, I think that it's a debatable topic, the role of melatonin in cancer care specifically, because there's just not conclusive research. I mean, one of the articles that we will link to in the show notes is from a journal called Pineal Research. Pineal Research. And it talks about melatonin and its role in cancer care. Let me pull that up just a second.
Pineal. Pecan. Pineal.
All right. There's an article in the Journal of Pineal Research in October of 2020, and its title is Melatonin Controversies, an Update. So the fact that this is a controversial subject, even in a journal that's for PhDs who do research in the field, tells you how complex the data must be if they can't make a consensus agreement on some of the roles of melatonin. So this was a nice paper, so it'll be in the show notes. And the reason I like it is because it, as of 2 years ago, tells you consensus. Everybody agrees on certain things, that melatonin is certainly in the cytoplasm. It's probably in the mitochondria.
That's part of a cell. That's like the soupy surroundings inside of a cell wall. Soupy surroundings?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We can picture a soupy surroundings.
I'm like the anti-nerd.
So yes, you have a cell that has a membrane around it. So think of it like a ball or a sphere with a fatty membrane on the outside. And then inside you have mitochondria and endoplasmic reticulum. You have Golgi apparatus. You have a nucleus. These things have to be, in something. What's between all of these organelles is the cytoplasm.
The soupy
stuff.
It's the broth.
The consensus of the physiological role of melatonin, there's definitely certain roles, right? We have melatonin receptors on cells. We have melatonin receptor 1, melatonin receptor 2s. They're on so many cells in the body. They're not just in the brain. And so this melatonin is having a net effect in cells all over the body. There are certain receptors that are agreed upon. There's others that we think there's certain receptors on other cells that melatonin binds to, but melatonin is difficult to study. So I'm saying this because there's a lot of controversy over, does melatonin have an effect on just certain disease states, or is it virtually every disease there is because there's receptors throughout the body? It seems to me that makes sense that it pretty much affects everything. Is there a toxic dose? One controversy is some people will say there's no toxic level. Technically, that's not been proven. And what are we defining as toxicity? Because we don't have anything on long-term toxicity. So if you take supraphysiological doses, doses that far exceed anything your body could make, and even far exceed what we would use for sleep. So we're talking about out there, some people are doing 100 or 300 milligrams, super physiological doses, way more than the body could possibly make. There is no safety studies on that. So there is an assumption when people do that, that there is no toxicity. Now, whether that's true or not, we can't prove that there's no toxicity. There could be a toxicity at a certain dose for a certain length of time that someone takes it, but we don't have any studies on the other side of that to say yay or nay on that. So this whole paper goes into all of this stuff and goes into it in great detail, including the crux of my whole should we or shouldn't we with melatonin? It's certainly an antioxidant at low doses. So the amount your body makes, likely the amount we use for sleep, are considered lower end doses. It acts as an antioxidant in both scavenging free radicals, most likely. There's mostly consensus on that. And it acts as an antioxidant by encouraging your cells to make powerful antioxidant enzymes like glutathione. So it's acting as an antioxidant at those levels. And this is why we have enough research to say, okay, at these lower levels, it's likely to protect us from ionizing radiation, right? So from an X-ray or gamma rays, which is the X-ray and CT scans.
So something I did find interesting is that, and it shows you how recent this melatonin research has been going on, like how recently, is that it was in 1993 that melatonin was identified as a free radical scavenger. And so that really wasn't that long ago, now that we are in
2023.
That's right. So just to kind of put it out there, like, you know, we're still learning a lot about melatonin.
Yeah, we didn't say that in our intro, but we probably should have. It was discovered, technically, in 1958, the molecule.
And what is its actual name?
Melatonin. N-acetyl-5-methoxytryptamine.
I don't know why it's not called NAM, right?
Well, I'm going to read from a paper because I came across this and I was like, oh, there's always tidbits of information that no matter how much you read, you're like, huh, well, there's a little trivia I didn't know. So this compound of indole structure, N-acetyl-5-methyltryptamine, is synthesized from serotonin. We said that already. This is directly from a paper. This aspect and the fact that it lightens the frog's skin by contracting melanophores led to the naming of this molecule as melatonin, as in melophore contracting hormone. In Greek, mela means black and tonin means tension or contraction.
That's why melanin, melatonin.
Yes. Unfortunately, some people cross wires with that. They are no way chemically related. Totally different compounds.
The word is related.
Yes. Because of a frog skin experiment in the beginning of this in the 1950s or 60s, whatever it is. Melanophore contracting hormone. Bad name.
Yeah. All right.
But come on, we're talking about a frog skin experiment. This was kind of cool.
I suppose. So the big thing that I think many people, maybe not everybody, but people have heard about, and this is kind of a segue of sleep and cancer. So there was the big nurses study, right, that showed that night shift work may be related to a higher incidence of certain cancers, like breast cancer.
Yes. It's to the point where it's been classified by the World Health Organization as a human carcinogen. Sleep cycle disruptions is considered a probable human carcinogen.
Yes. So I think like that's where most people think about like with melatonin and cancer. But we use it with our patients in different ways. There is a role for melatonin in terms of immune function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's actually some evidence. I mean, we kind of harp on the pineal gland because that's what we've looked at for decades. But immune cells have been found to produce melatonin inside their cells too. So how immune cells are affected by melatonin is, I think it's a hot topic in research right now. We're trying to figure it out. It may explain why melatonin seems to be useful as an adjuvant alongside immunotherapies in cancer care. Some of the early studies showed it was useful alongside immunotherapies.
Yeah, I know when we had patients receiving high dose IL-2 mm-hmm. for melanoma, which was getting IL-2 inpatient, like the patient had to be monitored because it was a really intense treatment. Melatonin was part of, you know, as naturopathic doctors, that was part of the protocol that we would use. It's also used alongside certain chemotherapies to help to support white blood cell count. It has been looked at in conjunction with fish oil to help with maintaining weight. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was in particular muscle mass, but, and I don't remember how definitive those studies were. I don't think we use the melatonin. I don't use the melatonin anymore. I think of more just using fish oil without the melatonin aspect. But I do remember learning at one point 20 milligrams melatonin plus I don't remember how many grams of fish oil together. That's kind of what was being used when I was going through my training mm-hmm. to help to reduce the risk of cachexia and weight loss.
Yeah. And so because I went through my residency back in 2000 to 2002, the 1990s studies, and we were using melatonin 20 milligrams on a pretty regular basis because of some studies that came out from the Lissoni group over in Italy, who used 20 milligrams and showed there was less fatigue during chemotherapy or there was less platelet deficiency.
Right. Blood abnormalities. Yeah.
Yeah. Myelosuppression or bone marrow damage. And so we were using it routinely at that level. And 20 milligrams to me is already a huge dose considering what our body already makes.
Right.
So this in the last, I want to say last year, not more than that, is when we suddenly are talking about 100 to 300 milligrams. And I think what's happening is people are extrapolating from rodent studies for the most part. And there is a way to extrapolate from rodent to human in the dosage. And it's not a one for one. It's not a linear thing. You can put in a little calculator online. We'll put a link in our show notes again for anyone who's interested in this. I'm not advocating doing it because the one thing we don't know is, you know, our physiology is different enough that I wouldn't say extrapolating from a rodent to a human is advisable when it comes to experimentation. Now, we're clinicians, and so experimenting with other people's bodies is unethical, in my opinion, and it is an experiment.
I think in many people's opinion.
No, we have plenty of colleagues and plenty of practitioners out there doing various bits and pieces of functional medicine that are doing this and advising people. And ultimately, when there is no study telling you what happens over a long term, you are experimenting on people. I think we need to be more honest about it. Because I think you're right. I think if people really thought about it, they may not advise these things. I think that there's this almost unwillingness to look at a negative side of things because you don't want to think that what you've been doing for the last 10 years or 20 years is negative. And so you kind of put up your blinders and just keep going forward. And I mean this in the best sense of it's our human nature. I don't think this is in any way malevolent. I just think it's human nature to not see your own blind spots. But I do think that there's too much experimentation going on. And this, we can whole nother discussion on therapies that I think are experimental. But if someone says, I'm going to do that with my body, I've looked at all the literature and I'm doing this. That's very different than me saying you should do that.
Right.
Those are two different decisions. So I think the 2022 paper that you had referenced earlier, Leah, was the one that has the title, Use of Melatonin in Cancer Treatment, Where Are We? And that came out in April of 2022. And that has all of the clinical trials as well as a lot of the rodent data in it that has been done thus far on melatonin in cancer care. So whether or not someone should be taking melatonin is a case-by-case basis. I could say right now, I don't think I would advocate the huge doses. I don't see why taking more than 20 milligrams should be done unless it's proven to be safe. I don't feel like there's a good safety parameter around it yet.
And you said the 20 milligrams came from those Lissoni studies.
Yes, yes. That's where it originated, as far as I know. As far as clinical trials. So he did a lot of small clinical trials. They were criticized for not being rigorous enough. Their design was criticized as well. But in any case, it became kind of the high dose that we use. So this whole new, I would say mega dose, is fairly new in the last year or so.
There are studies that show melatonin being synergistic with chemotherapies. It's not used as an alternative to treatment, but it's supposed to be, synergistic with conventional therapies, I should say. And one of the ones I think of the most is with tamoxifen, having that synergy with melatonin.
Yeah. There was a small trial alongside tamoxifen, and they took women who were progressing on tamoxifen. So they had metastatic breast cancer. It was 14 women, and they progressed on tamoxifen, and they took those same women, added melatonin, and a good number of them started to respond better. So the tamoxifen plus melatonin led to a better response. And these were people who were already progressing on tamoxifen, and that was the kind of amazing thing about this. Melatonin does have aromatase inhibition in its mechanisms of action. There's a lot of different mechanisms that melatonin can do within cells, lowering the aromatase enzyme action. And aromatase is the enzyme that allows your body to take precursors of estrogen and make them into estrogen molecules. And so blocking aromatase, as you know, there are aromatase inhibitors approved on the market. It doesn't do it anywhere near as effectively because those aromatase inhibitors inhibit the aromatase enzyme by up to 97-99%. So those inhibitors that are pharmaceutical are incredibly strong inhibitors of aromatase enzyme. Melatonin is considered, in comparison, a mild inhibitor, but it does inhibit aromatase enzymes.
So would somebody who's taking an aromatase inhibitor need to avoid melatonin?
I don't think so. But what they're doing, it's like, you know, putting a drop in the ocean kind of thing. It's not going to do anything. It's, the drug is such a potent inhibitor of that enzyme.
I was just thinking if somebody needed it for sleep.
Oh, yeah. It's
because I know that's going to be a question out there. I was just putting it out. I'm trying to think of like,
yeah,
you know, like questions. I'm trying to think of other things where like melatonin might actually be contraindicated or cautions. Caution would be, I know that, you know, it's often a warning if somebody is taking something that makes them drowsy, it may potentially like potentiate drowsiness. So that's one of the warnings you commonly hear.
I have definitely had people react poorly to 20 milligrams even. That dose has led to some people getting headaches and some people just feel like they can't wake up in the morning. So for whatever reason, their body does not metabolize it quickly. They wake up and they can't wake up. They feel groggy and sluggish and they don't really like waking that way. In which case, you know, obviously doing a lower dose might get rid of that. Some people have epic and deeply visual dreams.
Mm-hmm. That's what I heard.
So these are side effects. It's fascinating that the literature is not stronger about all of this. Like I came across a little bit that mentioned nightmares, irritability. I don't even think nightmares is what I get reported. I get people reporting that their dreams were like epic length and incredibly visual and colorful and
vivid. Yeah. I've heard vivid and disturbing. I haven't necessarily heard nightmare, but yeah, just where it's like, yeah, really vivid.
I'm fascinated by that.
So yeah, it's not something that everyone can take. Back to cancer, I know that there were some studies that looked at it to see if it did reduce mucositis, you know, the mouth sores that you can get from treatments. It's been looked at alongside radiation to help to reduce some of the effects of the bone marrow, where like, mm-hmm, you know, you can, your blood counts start to go down. For some who get radiation. And so it's supposed to help to counter that as well. If someone is taking a lower dose of melatonin, though, I do tend to stop it with radiation because of its action as an antioxidant.
Yeah, this is where it becomes a bit of a conundrum, doesn't it? Because we know melatonin can be protective from ionizing radiation, from damaging the bone marrow when you take an animal and you radiate it. Ionizing radiation is what is used for therapy. It's also what is used for x-rays and it's used for CT scans. Melatonin is one of those things that's fairly well proven to protect the body from ionizing radiation. So using it in some way, if you're someone who's going to be getting a lot of CT scans, because it will have a cumulative effect, I can see justification for using melatonin.
And that was one of the studies that Tim had sent us. And that was one that I couldn't read the study. It was just the abstract.
Yeah.
But that was interesting because I never thought of the use of melatonin for that. And that was a higher dose from what I could tell that was used in that study. And it's just for a short period of time. It's like, yeah, prior to getting a CT scan.
Yeah. And just for the record, CT scans are recognized as having a cumulative effect. And the industry, of course, answers that with how do we make a lower dose machine? So the CT scans of today are a much lower dose than, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So I want to say, put that out there because some of the data that we're looked at the use of CT scans a long time ago. So it's apples and oranges if we look at it now. But in any case, there's a role for it in that. Then you flip that coin and say, if you're getting radiotherapy or radiation therapy for your cancer, do you want melatonin in your system? If it's been a tried and true protectant of cells. And I think this is one of those where we say, yeah, maybe not. Maybe we just put that to the side and make sure you get what you want to get out of that radiation and find another way to get you to sleep and don't take that risk.
And the studies that I saw years ago that looked at melatonin with radiation, it was taking high dose melatonin for several days prior to starting radiation. And then the person would get their radiation. Again, the half-life of melatonin is 30 minutes, but the half-life of radiation is a lot longer. So even on, you know, on weekends, if somebody's like, can I just take my 3 milligram melatonin on the weekends to go to sleep? You're still taking a potential antioxidant supplement. So yeah, but if somebody is taking a higher dose of melatonin, you know, 20 plus milligrams, then it's not necessarily something that I will hold. And sometimes I talk to people about that with their chemotherapy, with radiation, if it's a higher dose, but it is expensive,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Is it? I don't remember the...
The 20 milligrams can be, you know, just in general, it can be expensive. I mean, there are people who take 5 milligrams and will take 4 of them and they're fine with that.
Right.
But Yeah, it's just all kind of like, it's for me, it's a case by case determination. It's not like across the board, everyone's getting the 20 milligrams of melatonin or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think some of the reason I'm hesitant is because of the unknown. And anyone who knows me knows that I do not extrapolate information easily because it gets us in a lot of trouble. If it was as easy as extrapolating from animals to humans, we would have solved a lot of diseases by now. So I'm really cautious. Melatonin has many other targets and physiological effects than just the melatonin receptors. So it looks like we're going to find out more and we're going to learn more and we're going to figure out exactly what it's doing to the immune cells, to the macrophages, and exactly what it's doing to everything and at what dose. But like so many things, what it does at low dose could be not identical to what it does at high dose. Where the line is drawn between high dose and low dose is also being debated in the literature, because answering that question is not easy. I delved into the literature. I've been doing this on and off for years with melatonin. Finally, we're getting closer, but it's still tough to translate it to what you put in your mouth and say how many nanomolars or how many micromolars does it take to have an oxidative effect, because it does probably oxidate at some level. Can we get there with an oral dose at all? I don't know, but I'm not going to take that chance with people taking, you know, hundreds of milligrams at a time. Back to the radiation. One of the confusing aspects of anything we talk about during radiation is if you layer on another oxidative therapy, then it's okay. But what we don't know is when melatonin goes from antioxidant to oxidant. So we don't know at what dose that happens. If we knew with any kind of confidence that it happens, certainly at such and such dose, 200 milligrams, 500 milligrams, whatever it's going to be, or intravenous melatonin. I don't know what it's going to take. But at whatever dose, if you knew you were layering on another oxidative therapy, that's fine. As far as theoretical, you know, outcomes, you're not going to get in the way of the radiation with more oxidation. You might have more side effects, but you won't get in the way of radiation. So the conundrum here is we don't have enough information to answer the question we need to answer, which is when melatonin becomes an oxidant, at what dose does that happen? Well, if we can answer that question, then we can be more definitive about dosing at higher ends.
And that's why I wanted to be able to have access to that one article, because it does talk about...
What's the name of it? Maybe I have it.
The article, I mean, it's from 1999, but it says the oxidant-antioxidant network, role of melatonin. And so if you have access to that, send it to me, because I don't have access to it. I think what we're basically saying is that there is benefit for melatonin in cancer care. Timing probably is a big part of it. Would you agree?
Timing in what sense of the word?
In terms of like when somebody would take the melatonin. I have had patients who take it during the day to help them to relax. I think it's not something that necessarily, like one of the big questions that I get with melatonin is, if I take it all the time, is it going to make my body stop producing? It's natural melatonin. Is it going to, you know, is there that feedback loop that's going to stop it? You know?
No. I think that was something that I ran into a lot for a long time, is I would prescribe melatonin for people. And then they go to the nutrition store or the grocer or whomever, get their melatonin. And somebody tells them, you know, if you take this, you're going to get hooked on it. It's going to stop your own production. Completely not correct. Which is why I kind of think of it like the ball rolling down a hill. This is going to happen. You're going to make serotonin. It's going to become melatonin when there's darkness. You can't affect that enzyme with anything but light and dark. Taking melatonin will not downregulate that enzyme. You don't have to worry about that. There is no negative feedback loop with melatonin, which is what you would have to have for that to be the case.
Trying to think of other oncology-related uses for melatonin, and there is that study showing that patients who took 5 milligrams of melatonin prior to getting, I think it's hysterectomies, that it helped with postoperative pain, morphine usage, and it also was like an anti-anxiety. If somebody is taking melatonin prior to getting surgery, it's always best to talk to the anesthesiologist and say, hey, guess what? This is something that I take. Like if you took it the night before surgery, it's even a good idea to mention these things. Trying to remember other melatonin things. But I think about, like, it's kind of cool because it's not just being looked at in cancer. It's being looked at in COVID. It was a big thing with COVID in terms of were people taking melatonin or not. It was looked at with patients with Alzheimer's to see its effect on cognitive function. I mean, it's just kind of like, I don't want to say that it's hot because I don't think that this is a current thing. I think this has been ongoing to look at the effect of melatonin on a lot of things like traumatic brain injury and sleep disturbances, you know.
Yeah, I seem to recall one that was for cardiovascular surgery too. It had to do with stents and better outcomes post-surgically. That was just this year, came across. But you know, whenever you're supporting normal physiology, I think that you can expect better outcomes. In other words, you know, especially when you talk about surgical interventions or things that are going to throw off your diurnal rhythm, maybe melatonin is useful in just supporting normal physiology. So I think that's a, like we always talk about, it's a different thing to support normal physiology than it is to give a supra physiological dose, in which case you're trying to elicit an action a lot like a drug action.
Right. So that would be like the number three green pharmacy,
right,
you know, reason to take something.
So some of our take-home points are taking lower doses for sleep can be indicated no matter where you are on the cancer continuum.
Unless you're getting radiation.
Right. Unless you're getting radiation, in which case, remember that melatonin is considered supporting your antioxidant pathways. So that can be risky. There's nothing proven to say that it interferes. But at the same time, you're committing to a toxic therapy that you don't want to undo in any, not even theoretically undo. So you can do a lot to repair tissues afterwards, and that's what you should concentrate on and not do anything that could even possibly get in the way during the treatment itself. Now, again, if and when we have levels that tell us, oh, it's no longer acting as an antioxidant, it is now being oxidative because it's dose dependent generally, that's a different story. But we do not know where that line is right now. We don't know how much it would take to get there. So abundance of caution. Post-treatment sleep issues are big in the survivorship population. So well over a third of patients who have had a diagnosis of cancer and have gone through treatment have sleep disturbances. So melatonin's high on my to-do list, you know, in those sleep amounts. And I consider 20 milligrams a really high dose. And so that's already a high dose, super physiological dose. So I don't see any reason to experiment with hundreds of milligrams in people until we know what we're doing.
Yeah, and the 20 milligram dose, people will take that for sleep. And I will often take them off of that and put them on a low dose and kind of pulse it between doing a high dose like 20 and a low dose, because the 20 milligrams isn't necessarily only supporting sleep. So yeah, so right. I kind of play with the dosage as well and with patients.
That makes sense. And yeah, so you can think of it like you would any drug. You take the lowest dose to achieve your desired response, mm-hmm. right? So there's no reason, you know, it says on the bottle, take two Advil, but if one works, why would you take two?
Right. So that kind of concludes our episode on melatonin. I hope we answered some questions and we probably brought up some more. So send us a letter. thecancerpod@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram, which is where I am the most. If you happen to be on the Facebook, you can look for us as well. We are The Cancer Pod on almost all, we're not on all modes of social media.
So yeah, hit that follow button. We have plenty of episodes coming up. Write to us if you're interested, and we'll have more interactive material as the year goes on. That's our big goal for 2023, is to have more interaction and to get to know some of our listeners, as we have gotten to know Tim a little bit.
And we're going to have a couple more episodes coming up on supplements 101. So, and I know we decided what they're going to be, but I'm not thinking of them right now because it's getting a little late. And so it'll be a surprise.
Yeah.
to all of us, to everyone involved.
We'll surprise ourselves.
That's right. If you enjoy what you are listening to, remember to buy us a coffee. Help us to cover our expenses of having a website and just doing all of the behind the scenes stuff. And like we mentioned, we have been planning a Patreon. And so we'll have more content available on that.
Yeah, keep an eye out for the Patreon, because if Supplements 101 is our podcast, then that may be the opportunity to go to 201 and 401 and such.
401 for the totally. And I feel like the more I mention Patreon, the more we're going to feel like, oh, we really got to get on this.
Yeah, let's just put the promise out there. And that way we'll have to meet the promise.
Yeah, we have to be held accountable. So yeah, and happy new year, I guess, to all of y'all out there in the listeners world.
Yeah. Welcome 2023. Here we go. Here we go. Here we go again.
Oh, on that note, I'm Dr. Leah Sherman.
And I'm Dr. Tina Kayser.
And this is The Cancer Pod.
Until next time.
Thanks for listening to The Cancer Pod. Remember to subscribe, review, and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social media for updates. And as always, this is not medical advice. These are our opinions. Talk to your doctor before changing anything related to your treatment plan. The Cancer Pod is hosted by me, Dr. Leah Sherman, and by Dr. Tina Kayser. Music is by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.
This 2023 is working out.
Work it out. Work it out. Work it out.